You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Russell Banks has written three novels over the past 13 years, but now he has returned to short fiction. Readers who have come to know him through Continental Drift, Lost Memory of Skin, and Cloud Splitter can rest assured, however, that the themes that have characterized his work, isolation and being an outsider, all while trying to connect with others, appear throughout this new collection of short stories called A Permanent Member of the Family. I enjoyed my conversation last month with two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist Russell Banks, so we're re-airing it for you on this Boxing Day. I began by noting that this is his sixth collection of stories, but it's the first one he's published in 13 years, and I asked Russell Banks, have you been writing short stories all along? Because all of these seem to be fairly new.
They're almost all very recent, yes, since I finished the last novel, Lost Memory of Skin. I used to alternate more, you know, while writing a novel, I might write a few stories here and there, take a break. But as you mentioned, the last three novels, I wrote one after the other, and when I finished this most recent one, I felt a little burnt out and exhausted. And remember that when you write stories, you're really working with a different part of your brain than when you write novels. It feels almost the part that I think that with which you might write poetry or do mathematics or something. And it's a whole different energy that you can get. And so I sat down and for a year and a half wrote stories and nothing else. And that's what the book reflects.
Well, your first success was Searching for Survivors, mm-hmm. which is a collection of short stories that won the O. Henry Award in mm-hmm. the mid-1970s. Mm-hmm. So you must remember the form with some fondness.
Yeah, with great fondness. I do love it. And also I started writing even before that as a poet. And as a relationship to language and to form with short stories, it's very like the kind of relationship one takes with regard to writing lyric poetry, for instance. And for instance, one of the effects of a story is that when you get to the end of a story, you sort of expect to remember the beginning. And it makes sense if you can. If you can't remember the beginning, oftentimes it doesn't make sense. And so, which is also true of a lyrical poem or of a song.
But not a Russian novel where sometimes you need to have a list of all of the characters at the beginning so that you can remind yourself who these different people are. But I wonder how that works when you're writing. Is a novel more all-consuming because you're going to live with it for
quite a while? Yeah, I think that's it. You become immersed in that fictional world. And it's also, in some ways, the point of a novel when you're writing it, just as when you're reading it, is that you forget the beginning. You get 70 pages into a novel just as in your own life. You can't remember the beginning because it imitates the flow of time much more closely than a short story does.
Also, some people start writing a novel at one point, and that winds up being chapter 5. It can get a lot more complicated. With a short story, the revisions are a lot quicker, I assume. But do you outline your short stories the same way you do your novels?
No. I work pretty differently. With a story, I'm much more trusting of just the process. And it's probably because it's short enough and you're close enough to it, all its parts, that you can keep track of them more easily. But usually I start sometimes with an image, sometimes with just a sentence, a line, a situation, a very small situation. When I started these stories, I went back and went through my notebooks going back for about 10 years, and I had a little sketch here or a note here and a note there, and I went through them all, typed them all out, and there were maybe, 75 or 80 of these little notes, and went through and found and identified the 12 that I wanted to stay with. And it wasn't because they were most detailed or outlined or structured or anything. There was just something there that drew me to it, a thread that I wanted to tug on until I could unravel the whole thing.
So there is a kind of a common theme here? Do they all bounce off of each other?
I didn't intend that, but it turns out to be the case. The title is A Permanent Member of the Family, and it's meant a little bit ironically.
Well, all members of the family are permanent, whether the family wants it or the member wants
it. Yeah, in a sense. And also it's sort of like a permanent – if you're born Catholic, you're a permanent Catholic, whether you've lapsed or not. But it's the idea, I think, that comes out of these stories over and over and over again is both the – incredibly powerful need we have for family and as an agency of intimacy and respect and protection on the one hand, and on the other hand, the incredible fragility of family and how easily it comes undone.
Because they're constantly shifting and changing.
Yeah, and people's needs are deeply conflicted, and we're all kind of inadequate when you get down to it. And so we can't quite live up sometimes to the responsibilities of family.
Well, many of your characters have been outcasts of one sort or another. Should we be surprised that many of the protagonists in these stories are kind of on the outside looking in?
I guess not. You know, I didn't set out to do that, and I don't have a program or an ideology that drives me there. But
well, there are certain things that probably you are attracted to.
Yes, that's it. And I think I've thought about where does that come from. It's got to have some origins in my own personal life. And I've been thinking about lately back to my own childhood and youth and in the 1940s and 1950s. When my own family kind of broke up, my father and mother were divorced in 1952, and my father essentially abandoned the family, and it was a family marred also by alcoholism and violence. And in the early 50s and late 40s, this made you feel marginalized. You know, divorce, alcoholism, domestic violence, secrets made you feel marginalized. And I think that stayed with me. I think even now, here I am in my 70s, and I still have that quick identification with people who themselves, are, for other reasons, are marginalized.
And you're right about that in the title story. I'm going to quote, you write, "Most of us aren't emotionally or intellectually ready to lose our innocence until our 30s or even later. So when one loses it prematurely in childhood and adolescence through divorce or the sudden early death of a parent, it can leave one fixated on that loss for a lifetime. Because it's premature, it feels unnatural, violent, and unnecessary. It leaves one angry at the world."
Yeah, I think that's true.
So were you angry at the world?
I think I was when I was younger, by far. And I think that the process of writing and the discipline that it imposed upon me and the requirements of honesty and straightforwardness that it imposed upon me allowed me to deal with that anger and to turn it to, I hope, to good use.
But when the things were happening, you were young. Mm. Did you feel that you were losing your innocence prematurely?
No, I didn't have a vocabulary for it, of course, and nor did I have any frame of reference for it. It's only in retrospect, you know, that you can stand back and look at it as an adult and say, oh, I see that's what was happening there. And I could also see it – I mean, I'm divorced as well, and I could see it
four
in my
times.
Own children. Yes, and I'm three.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I hope your current isn't
yes,
listening.
Yes, no, I finally got it right. But, you know, I could see it in my own children, too, the same effect, you know, of loss of innocence.
My guest is Russell Banks, whose latest book is his first short story collection in quite a few years. It's called A Permanent Member of the Family. Your story, Big Dog, seems to explore the double-edged sword of success when its protagonist suddenly receives a MacArthur.
Yeah.
Can success be as destabilizing as failure?
Yeah, I think in that story it is, and it can easily be in the sense that this kind of magic success, you know, MacArthur, or it could be any number of other kinds of forms of sudden excess, which seems all out of proportion to the work that earned it. And you get very superstitious and anxious and insecure as a result, and that character does in the story, and it alters his relationships with his friends and with his wife, and his marriage suddenly seems to have all kinds of cracks he didn't realize were there and so forth. So, yeah, it is an attempt to kind of roll a bowling ball of success into the room and see what happens, see who gets knocked over.
It actually opens up all the disillusionments that can happen in a marriage.
And also it's a story, too, I think about Big Dog. I mean, that's the wife's name for him because he's the alpha dog, and I was trying to portray too that not-so-subtle balance that that men acquire, you know, when they lay out who's the alpha and who's the beta and how easily it can be upset. So the story is an unfolding of the drama, a competition in a way, between a much younger man who seems not to be a famous artist of any sort, he can't finish his first novel, and then this older man who's just got the MacArthur grant and the kind of power play between the two.
I noticed in the first two stories here there's a character called the Old Man. Have the themes that you write about changed as you've grown older?
I think the characters have changed since I became an old man myself, in a way. I noticed, looking at these stories, that most of the characters are middle age and older, and late middle age, and a few even elderly. And so I think that's a shift, definitely. And also, in this case, I think a third of the stories are about women, too. And they're very central to the stories.
Well, you have returned to certain settings here, the Adirondacks in upstate New York and South Florida, where Lost Memory of Skin was set. Mm-hmm. And you do split your time between the two places, don't
you?
Yeah,
I have this kind of bipolar life, in a way. I live on the northern border, so it's easy to get to Canada, get out of the country that way, 6 months. And then the southern border, so it's easy to get out of the country to, from Miami.
Well, how important is setting in a story? Could a story just as easily have taken place in New York or Chicago or rural Wisconsin as...
Well, not for me. It's interesting you ask, because I've lived in lots of places I've never written about. I lived in Princeton, New Jersey for many years, lived in New York City for many years, Boston, and I've never written about them. One or two little stories I wrote about North Carolina, but always the Outer Banks, the ocean, not where I did live, which was Chapel Hill in central in the Piedmont. And I don't know for sure why that's the case, but I do know that there are a few places that when you enter them, when I entered them, they seemed just resonant. Everything seemed significant, just the sound of it, the smell of it, the light, the fall of the light. And it doesn't go away. I mean, today
But they're very different.
They're very different.
Upstate New York
and
Florida.
It's hard to say why is one place more interesting and important and emotionally laden than another. It's hard to say. I entered upstate New York, northern New England, when I was a child, a very small child, and therefore in a kind of totally responsive and yet somewhat chaotic state of mind. And I entered South Florida when I was 18 years old the first time in a similarly open but chaotic state of mind. And it may be that I was so much more receptive at those moments that everything seemed significant to me. And it's never really gone away.
A few of the stories touch on economic fragility as well. The foreclosure crisis hit Florida particularly hard. Could you see the impact of the financial meltdown in upstate New York as well?
Oh, yeah, and there's a story there that touches on that. It's the first story, former Marine, where the man is an older man in his late 60s, maybe. It's not said exactly, who has lost his job and and also lost his house and over-mortgaged and loses his self-respect and turns to crime just to make ends meet.
I read a review, and the reviewer said that you're interested in narrative and character development, and I thought, aren't most writers interested in that?
Yeah, I should think so.
But do you think that that's particularly true of you?
Narrative and character. I'm a storyteller, and naturally you rely very heavily on narrative in order to make a story coherent and have any kind of drama to it. And you have to have characters, and they have to develop, and they have to change. They have to want something they either can't get or can get, and that changes them, and whichever it is. So in a way, it's not to say very much. I'll tell you what I am really interested in with short stories, maybe especially, but it's also true for novel writing, is I'm really interested when I'm writing that I see what it is that's happening in the fictional world with my eyes, my inner eyes, and that I hear what's happening. I hear the characters speak to one another, that I essentially have auditory and visual hallucinations.
So you're walking down the street and you actually hear a conversation? In your head?
When I'm sitting at my desk, I do, yes. I try to avoid doing it when I'm walking down the street because it's a little dangerous. But yeah, and I'll read them out loud if necessary so I can hear that dialogue. And I'm seeing what I'm saying, in a sense, in a very literal sense. And so I think that that's, A, it's very important to me as a writer, but that's because it's also very important to me as a reader. And when I read fiction, I really want to be able to have out-of-the-body travel, in a sense, and see things and hear things that I can't see or hear otherwise.
Do you tend to read some of the classics still, or older fiction, or do you keep up with what's going on right now?
Tennessee Williams, I think when he was close to my age, was asked, you know, what do you think of the young playwrights? And he said, I'm too old to cover the waterfront, honey. Well, I sort of am too old to cover the waterfront. I read my friends and my peers, my contemporaries, writers, and writers who I've read for many years, and then go back and return every once in a while to the classics and go back and say, I should have read that. Now I'm going to try. For instance, I want to go back and reread Dos Passos. I haven't read Dos Passos since I was in my 20s.
Probably the most underrated great writer of the 20th century, perhaps because of his politics.
I guess so. But, you know, his politics weren't that radical. I mean,
well, he went from being far left to far right.
Yeah,
and so
in that sense, his
friends felt he'd abandoned
them. Yeah, but that was, you know, that was then and this is now. And those, I remember reading those books, the USA Trilogy, and just being blown away by them when I was in my 20s. And I'd love to go back and check my response again.
I'm not going to ask you what it's about, but I'm assuming there's another novel in the works?
Yeah, I started writing another novel, yes.
Meanwhile, we have these short stories, all very recent. Most of them, some of them published elsewhere, but a lot of them appearing for the first time in this book from Echo called A Permanent Member of the Family. Russell Banks, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great to be here.
Up next, New Yorker staff writer Ian Frazier and Coalition for the Homeless president Mary Brosnahan discuss why homelessness in New York is at its highest level since the Great Depression and what incoming Mayor Bill de Blasio should consider doing about it. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate.